Coming up today, Facebook takes to the skies, what SoftBank's Arm deal means for the UK tech industry, and we get spooked by an innovative new VR theatre production. You're listening to episode 277 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
And Roland Manthorpe.
Hello.
Now, Matt, earlier this week, you tried out a sort of self-driving car with a difference.
Yeah, I went up to a Jaguar Land Rover near Birmingham and tried out one of their new Range Rovers, which is an experimental research stage. And basically, it maps the road in front of it. It scans the ground in front of it and plots out what terrain it's on and if there's any bumps and hills, and basically drives itself across them.
And all you do is the steering?
Yeah, all I was doing was steering. I set the speed to like a maximum speed, and then the car worked out the correct speed it needed to be going for the terrain it was going on. So when I went over a bump, it sort of sped up going over the bump, and when I went down to a water pit, the Range Rover basically slowed itself down and put itself into a mode which it's comfortable of driving in the water with.
Now, you're speaking to two people, I can tell by Roland's expression, that aren't massive petrol heads. Why is this important? Because in my mind, that kind of driving is fun. So why would you want the car to do it for you?
I think it depends on what you're doing. If you're on a safari or something and you're just sitting in the back of a car and this car was basically driving itself, maybe that could be a bit more just relaxing rather than having to have somebody control the car through like a really rough...
So you can take your pictures.
Yeah, really. I don't know if there's a really big application for this. It's not going to be as big as cars, self-driving cars in the cities and things like that. But it is just, I guess if you are a company that is producing off-road vehicles and self-driving technology is coming, whether they like it or not, then they want to research it and want to do this themselves.
And this is interesting because the major application of self-driving cars at the moment, aside from this and related things that I know Ford are doing, is in cities, and particularly in American cities that are on very set grids. So this presents all kinds of different challenges and isn't something that seems to be making headlines as much. So it was, you can watch the video of Matt driving around and doing his best impression of Richard Hammond from Top Gear on wired.co.uk. Go and check that out. Roland, a thing you learnt this week.
So I learnt that sadly an old technology is coming to an end as the Funai Corporation of Japan, the last company to manufacture VCRs, has announced that it's going to stop making them.
Why? Why on earth are they going to stop? I mean, I watch my Pocahontas VHS every weekend.
I can just imagine.
Yeah, I know all the songs.
even you wouldn't believe it, but 750,000 units were sold worldwide last year. But the company said that it's impossible to find the parts to keep the machines going.
Fair enough, I suppose.
Yes.
So next stop, my massive DVD collection. We'll be consigned to the scrap heap, I suppose.
Oh, dear. That's very sad.
Yeah, it really is. Matt Burgess, the thing you learnt this week.
Well, for those people not in London, it's been, and in the UK even, it's been really hot this week. It's been like 30 degrees, which is pretty rare for the UK.
It gets us very excited for some reason.
So this week I've actually learnt what the hottest platform on the underground network under London was. So would you guys care to take a guess at which station this was? And I'll give you a, it's not really a clue, I guess, but the average reading for the month of August last year, this station was 31.69 degrees Celsius.
You're right, that's not a clue at all.
No, it's not. But
Roland, you go first.
Okay, I am going to go for, based on nothing at all, Tottenham Court Road.
You're wrong.
Angel.
And you're also wrong. It's Marble Arch on the Central Line.
Ah, but it was the Central Line. We were talking about this before we started recording. The Central Line is, it feels like it's close to hell. It's very, very, very steamy. The thing I learned this week is that hatching 2 kilometer eggs on Pokemon Go is essentially pointless. Absolutely pointless. Don't do it. That's a fact.
Why? What have you hatched?
Oh, nothing worthwhile.
Well,
the odd Jolteon, a magic
top. How many have you hatched?
Too many, Roland. Or not enough. Our first story this week. Roland, Facebook has reached a significant milestone in its bid to provide internet to even the most locations of the globe, and by extension, Facebook. What's been going on?
Indeed. So Facebook's connectivity lab completed its first full-scale test flight of its high-altitude internet-providing aircraft. So this is a solar-powered plane designed to beam connectivity to places that can't support the normal sort of infrastructure you need to provide web connections.
So we're talking cables on the ground, switches, cabinets, all these kind of things.
All those sorts of things.
The idea is that you can just fly a drone over areas and ta-da, internet appears.
Yes, exactly. So this aircraft is got the wingspan of an airliner. It flies at about 65,000 feet and it can stay in the air for 3 months. And essentially what it is a great big mobile phone mast in the sky.
Okay, and it's incredibly, incredibly efficient. That's how it can stay in the air for 3 months. It consumes basically no power.
Well, that's partly because it's solar powered and it's very near the sun. So in theory, and it doesn't actually do this right now, but it can take power from the sun and stay up there. And it consumes about as much power during a typical flight as 3 hairdryers. So about the amount of power that you take to dry your beard in the morning, James.
Yeah, it requires 3 hairdryers, left, right and under. Yeah, there's a technique to that. It's not just... Stop laughing. It's not just Facebook that's doing stuff like this. There's Google with its Loon project, and there's various companies that are testing the idea of putting lots of nanosatellites into near-Earth orbit and using them to create massive networks that can beam, as they put it, internet to very, very remote areas that currently either rely on mobile connections or satellite connections.
Exactly. And in theory, it's a very admirable goal. For only 40% of the world has an internet connection, and there are all sorts of associated benefits with having an internet connection in terms of education, even in terms of female liberation. But there are some difficulties with Facebook's plan, and I know Matt has been looking into this.
Yeah, so not this direct scheme, but one that is very similar that Facebook's been doing is a scheme it started a few years ago called Free Basics. It was actually, when it was initially started, was called internet.org, and basically it is a scheme that gives people free internet access around the world, but only to certain websites, basically.
Those websites include Facebook.
Facebook, yeah. Facebook is the main one. But it's been a bit controversial. So in India, earlier this year and last year, basically the case has been ongoing for quite a while. The Indian government basically banned this and other platforms on the basis of it wasn't providing a net neutrality, basically equal internet access for all.
Yeah, Roland.
Because a few weeks ago, or was it a month ago, you spoke to Nikhil Parva, who led the campaign against Free Basics in India. Because I read your piece about it. It was really interesting. I mean, what was he like to speak to?
So Nikhil, for people who don't know, he was the person who led this campaign that eventually ended up with the banning of Facebook Free Basics. And he was saying that this, because you're only providing internet connection to a certain number of platforms and partners, it's limiting what people can actually get on the internet and do. And it's basically meaning that those people who are using this sort of platform just have a really limited access to the internet, and they don't know what's out on the whole of the free internet. So it's really just a limited, you could say censored, that may be going a little bit far, but in some respects, you're not getting the full experience of the internet. And we all know the internet is massive. There's a lot of stuff on there, good and bad.
A lot of stuff. And some people have phrased this as sort of Facebook's sort of colonial imperialism, that it's going out into parts of the world and trying to impose its own structures, its own rules, with the veil of opening up the internet to more people, but under the true goal of making more people use Facebook. And it's a hugely controversial area. And Free Basics / Internet.org was doing quite well and spreading quite widely until it came to India. And it was when it came to India that it really hit a big problem, and a lot of people there didn't like it.
Yeah, and Nikhil, and part of the campaign that he was, where he was co-founder of the campaign, that got more than 1 million people in India supporting opposing this sort of thing. And actually all those people wrote to the government regulator, and they eventually banned this type of project. But Facebook Free Basics is still big around the world. A lot of people still use it. Facebook say that it will actually get more people online, because people will be able to see what the internet's like, and then they'll want to access more of it, so they will go to try and connect to and pay more to go on the full open internet.
And Mark Zuckerberg did a really interesting big interview with Casey Newton in The Verge this week, talking about the next 10 years for Facebook. And Free Basics and internet for people around the world was the number one thing he named as his big priority. So I don't think this is going to go away anytime soon.
It's 4 billion customers.
Exactly. Yes, that is one way of looking at it. Or, as Mark Zuckerberg would say, 4 billion people who need connectivity and need that special internet juice that we all know and love.
Yeah, and let's give Facebook a fair shake here. So it says that it aims to give away the blueprints for its drones and other internet devices so that anyone from local governments to internet service providers in the developing world can construct a new way to get internet signals to hard-to-reach places. It's an area that there's going to be a lot of competition, and it's going to be Facebook and Google and Qualcomm and Microsoft. All the big players are going to want to have a share of these emerging markets and the desire for better connectivity, faster connectivity. So over the next few years, it's going to be huge.
And interesting little subplot to all this, Aquila, which is the name of the plane that is going to be providing this internet, is made not in Shenzhen or in Silicon Valley, but in Somerset. So there's a UK connection to this all as well.
Which segues perfectly onto our second story this week, which is all about another major UK tech company, Arm. And this is potentially the biggest UK tech company. So earlier this week, SoftBank proposed a £24 billion takeover for Cambridge-based Arm Holdings. This is a company that you might not have heard of, but if you're holding a phone or a tablet or a laptop at this moment, chances are something Arm designed is in it. But this deal has proven to be quite controversial. Some analysts speaking to Wired have said that it appears to be an opportunistic move in the wake of the EU referendum. Just to give you some background, shortly before the Japanese telecoms firm, this is SoftBank, announced the deal, Arm's share price against the yen was 20% down on its peak over the last 12 months. The pound's weakness after the EU referendum result may have wiped as much as $5 billion off Arm's valuation to Japanese investors, according to one analyst. SoftBank CEO Masayoshi Son said the deal was not opportunistic and its timing was simply because the company finally had the cash. Although Son revealed that he'd only met Arm's chairman 2 weeks ago, which pretty much puts that meeting a couple of days after the referendum result. And it's a coincidence that some people found too hard to ignore. So let's stop there. How big a deal is this deal?
Well, I guess that maybe a good place to start is with Arm. Their client list reads like a dictionary of major tech companies. AMD, Apple, Broadcom, Samsung, Huawei, IBM, Intel, and so on, Qualcomm. And as you mentioned, if you've got a mobile device, and also if you've got any kind of Internet of Things devices in your home, like a Nest thermometer, chances are it will have an Arm chip in.
Yeah, and this was a big point that SoftBank made as to why they saw Arm as being so hugely valuable, that they don't just power or design things that power the smartphones and the tablets that we know and love and that become essential to our lives, but they're also developing the infrastructure that's going to power the next generation of devices, the Internet of Things layer, the things that sit in your home and you don't really realize that they are computers, but they are, like your Nest thermostat, like your smart oven, like your light system that's hooked up to your car, that's hooked up to your phone, that's hooked up to your brain. This is where they see it going, and there's huge value in this market.
To put a bit more context on that value, a few weeks ago when Microsoft bought LinkedIn, that was for $26.2 billion, which was about £18 million. So this deal is about £6 billion more than the whole cost of LinkedIn.
Yeah, so just to go back to the timing thing, I spoke to Neil Campling, who's the global head of telecoms, media and technology research for Northern Trust Capital Markets. And he was very, very strong on this. He described the speed of the deal as stunning. As someone that's said he spent a lot of time very close to these kind of large, complex deals, to go from first meeting to holding a press conference where you say that this proposed deal will go ahead with shareholder blessing and regulatory approval, it's pretty rapid. In his words. Paul Miller, senior analyst at Forrester, argued that the coincidence was pretty hard to ignore. The post-referendum situation means that the pound is down, he said. Arm is potentially billions of pounds cheaper than it was a fortnight ago. But he added that there was clearly an element of opportunism in the timing of the deal. But we must not rule out the fact that Arm is worth having, he said. It's a good catch. It's just a cheaper catch. And that's the other element of this story, that this was the jewel of British technology companies. And has it gone cheap?
Well, that's an interesting question, because actually, the moment after the announcement, SoftBank shares dropped fully 10%, mainly because investors thought that this price was a bit too high.
So that's the other interesting thing. They paid a premium. Arm's valuation was, I think, maybe £6 to 8 billion below what SoftBank offered. But as one analyst put it to me, IP, which is what Arm is all about, intellectual property, it's really, really difficult to invest in. There aren't that many companies around with really, really great IP. And you have to pay extra for that. So, yes, they paid a lot, but maybe they still got a very good deal because the potential for Arm to expand is incredible.
Well, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, and I guess it all depends on your assessment of Arm. I mean, I was saying that I thought it was one of the most important tech companies in the world, although weirdly, it's the one of the most important tech companies that no one has really heard of. And you were saying, well, now you thought, what was your word, small fry?
Yeah, and it's small fry in terms of name value.
Speaking,
so
yeah.
Microsoft investing in LinkedIn is arguably more headline grabbing because most people have heard of LinkedIn. But let's just go over this again. So in 2015, ARM processor designs were in around 15 billion chips. It has a 32% market share. Around 45% of ARM-based chips went into mobile devices, and ARM estimates that the total value of chips with processors sold in 2015 was $115 billion. This was a company founded in Cambridge in 1990, a joint venture between Acorn Computers, which an awful lot of listeners in the UK will remember from that period, Apple and VLSI. It opened offices in Silicon Valley and Tokyo, and unlike Intel, which is perhaps the best known chip manufacturer in the world, ARM doesn't manufacture chips, it designs them and then licenses its technology to other companies. So you're likely to find ARM designed chips in your Apple phone, HTC, Nokia, Samsung, Sony, pretty much you name it. If you've got a portable games console, there's probably an ARM designed chip in there somewhere.
It wasn't much reported at the time, but actually I think it's a few months ago, Intel announced that it was going to stop making a particular kind of chip. And that was it. ARM won. The war was over. ARM defeated Intel, one of the best known companies from the original tech boom, one of the great original tech centers, ARM won. But it is funny that no one's ever heard of it. Although I think actually from ARM's point of view, that was in many ways intentional. They liked it that way. And I guess, I mean, this whole kind of Brexit thing, and is it about Brexit? Is it British, keeping British companies in Britain? It feels like it's a story about Brexit and how that about the UK rather than necessarily about ARM. Because I mean, all their clients are abroad. They are an international company, and you know, the currency thing, currency goes down, profits go up. So it shouldn't really affect the value that much. I mean, I tend to feel like that's not really the story.
Yeah, for me, I feel it does show that how good Britain's tech sector is as well, and how much what we can develop and what we have got here. If we take away all the Brexit stuff like that, Cambridge is a big centre for technology, a big centre for new products and stuff in this country. So, for example,
you were talking to one of the leading lights of the Cambridge tech sector, Eben Upton.
Yeah, the founder of the Raspberry Pi Foundation, who they've obviously sold millions of small Raspberry Pi computers around the world. And he was saying on this very ARM deal that he thinks it shows the strength of talent and technology that is in Cambridge and is in this country and the area he thinks brings people to work here. And while it may not be the same size as Silicon Valley or the manufacturing in Shenzhen, it does show that there is a lot of quality talent in this country and people will invest in it and people will pay a lot of money to acquire things that are made in Britain.
Yeah, and by the sounds of it, SoftBank are going to keep an awful lot of that talent in the UK, and I think they said that they were looking to double ARM's workforce in the UK around Cambridge over the next few years. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. There's a chance that the deal might not go to SoftBank. There's others sniffing around the deal. We've heard from analysts, Samsung, Intel, Apple, a few other names. But obviously that gets a bit tricky, particularly if Intel get interested. So from Silicon Fen, as it's often called by nobody ever, to Silicon Valley, Elon Musk has once again been saying some eye-catching things this week. Matt Burgess?
Yeah, so Elon Musk, if anybody who doesn't know and has probably been living under a bit of a rock, is the co-founder of Tesla, which is an electric car company who's been selling a lot of cars recently. He co-founded PayPal back in the day, which was bought by eBay for $1.5 billion, and Elon Musk got $165 million from that deal, which he has used to channel into Tesla and also SpaceX, which is his company, which is basically aiming to send people to Mars eventually. So this week he is a big spokesperson for a lot of sustainable and clean energy and things like that. And he set out what he's going to do with Tesla in the coming weeks.
And years.
and years as well.
Yeah.
So he laid out part two of his master plan, which
and
is...
And he'd even refer to it as a master plan.
Yeah, that he called it a master plan, which is a little bit like an evil villain, but I think if you're such a billionaire as he is, you can get away with that a little bit. So just to go back a little bit, part one of his big plan for Tesla was actually published 10 years ago. It was published on Tesla's website and has been there for a long time. And it actually... That part of it was setting out the last decade for Tesla. And he basically said, we're going to start making electric cars. They're going to be really expensive to begin with. They're going to cost a lot of money. Not a lot of people are going to buy them. But the second generation, more people will buy them. It will be cheaper. The third generation, which we've just got to, and they have, he's actually sold 400,000 pre-orders of the new Model 3, I think it is, that's coming out later this year and next year, is the cheapest version. And that's where he's got to. So basically, scaling up. And these are all built on battery technology.
Yeah, and going forwards towards sustainability, getting away from fossil fuels, making sustainability available to more and more people, not just people who can afford $200,000 cars or however much the most expensive Teslas cost. So that was part one of the plan. What is part two?
So part two is all focused on sustainable energy. And this is a quote from his blog post that he wrote about this. He said, we must at some point achieve a sustainable energy economy or we will run out of fossil fuels to burn and civilization will collapse.
This is why he's quite quotable, isn't it?
Yeah, he is very quotable.
He doesn't mince his words.
No, he doesn't. So his plan basically said is all themed around that. And it's basically broken into a few areas. The first one is to do with transport in cities. So Tesla up to now has been working on electric cars and that's all they've been doing. But going forward, and they've already been working on these and they'll be revealed next year, there's going to be an electric bus and an electric truck from Tesla as well. So these are basically aimed to bring down the big CO2 emitting massive lorries and buses that are going through our cities. So that's one of the main things. And the second main thing to do with transporting cities and bringing down the amount of CO2 emissions again is more autonomy in Tesla's cars, which isn't surprising.
So he wants Tesla cars to essentially be no one really to own them, and they operate as an autonomous fleet of taxis, so that you have a lot less cars because they're always filling in the little gaps where people need them, rather than them sitting clogging up the city all day, people driving around and leaving them unused.
No, yeah. Parking. There'd be no parking, would there? There'd be no cars on the street?
No, that is exactly the idea. So basically, if Roland owns a Tesla in the future, and this is in a future where every car is autonomously driving around a city, so we're looking a little way into the future here. If Roland owns a Tesla, he can say, oh, I'm at work now, I don't need this. I'm going to put this into the fleet mode, so it's going out, and then James orders it on his iPhone and pays Roland for the... to use the car. You will be able to use Roland's autonomous car. It will come to you and drive you around.
And he'll be able to dry his beard on the way because he's not having to drive with his hands.
Yeah, I'll be able to use all three hair dryers and carbon offset the use of those hair dryers by the fact that I'm driving an electric car that's probably solar powered.
What a beautiful, beautiful vision.
Well, isn't it though? Is it? Is it?
Is it?
So this vision, I think, relies very much on the idea of a very modern, clean, ordered city. And from life experience, cities are not modern and ordered and clean. And I don't think they ever will be, necessarily. They're messy, dysfunctional, broken, problematic. And to suggest that you can take technology and make it all very clean and neat and Uberified is pushing things a bit.
I know. I think the thing that I find that the most interesting, say, about autonomous vehicles is thinking about the crossover period. I mean, what will happen when it's 30% autonomous and 70% people just driving around in their normal way and stepping out in front of cars and so on? And then what will happen when it's 70% autonomous? I mean, then you'd think there'd be a point when there'll be a few holdouts who insist on driving the old-fashioned cars, and what, maybe the government will have to step in and ban them? Or maybe it'll be something like you only use autonomous cars in the motorways and then you get those into the cities and then... I don't know what they do. They just sort of float around on the motorways and you get out and then you have parking things all around the edges of cities. So you drive in. It's all the kind of the scenarios and the kind of setups you see, it's all goes straight from 0 to 100. And in reality, as we know, there's always this muddy middle period, which kind of carries on forever and ever.
And I wonder if there will be certain places, and particularly your mind drifts to America for this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Las Vegas. why not just make the whole of Las Vegas autonomous in terms of driving? You've got what, like a 15 lane road that runs right down the middle of the Las Vegas Strip. Why not just make that entirely autonomous? It's a big straight line. Cars just need to pull into casino lobbies and pull out again. It's ideal for it. Most of the cars are taxis anyway. Getting around Vegas is a nightmare unless you take the monorail. And it seems like the kind of place where you wouldn't need that grey area. And it's just a strip next to a freeway.
Oh, it's ideal because one big thing about autonomous cars is the productivity, or rather the time they'd free up. So you could even have gambling in the cars. You could have cars sponsored by the casinos.
Yes, Roland. Yes.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry, but this is completely inevitable, isn't it?
And they could keep drinking in the cars.
Yes, indeed. Well, because, I mean, of course, all these cars are going to be funded by advertising, right? I mean, they're being made by Google and Tesla and Uber. That is inevitable. So I agree, James. It's perfect. I can't wait.
It will make Vegas even more fun.
Even better.
It really will. What do you think, Matt Burgess?
I think it's going to happen. It's fairly inevitable, as Roland said. And probably that model that you put up of Las Vegas is probably somewhere an example of what will happen. Because, as we say, we're not going to have a whole city just overnight turned into an autonomous driving zone. I think it's probably going to be more around, small test beds that expand and get bigger until it becomes more ubiquitous and it's more across everywhere. And obviously, that's going to be a long way off, and there's going to be somebody who is 75 in a really old battered car that doesn't want to go in an autonomous car. And how long until we just have all autonomous cars? It's going to be quite a while.
Yep. And having said Vegas, it will probably be some city in China that they build and haven't even started building yet, and will be one of the biggest cities in the world in the next 20 or 30 years. So maybe it will be that instead. There's food for thought. Roland, earlier this week, or maybe last week, you went to a futuristic bit of theatre that was based around virtual reality. We're going to talk a bit about the modes of storytelling in VR and the tools that are available to people and the language of that storytelling. But first of all, tell us a bit about this production that you went to see.
Yes, so last week I went to see Control, which is a production by a new company called Breaking Forth. And it's one of the first pieces of long-form VR storytelling, the first piece that I've ever seen. And it was extremely interesting to see when it worked and when it didn't work. Because what it did was, the idea was that it was taking inspiration from traditional theatre rather than, say, film or games. And many people think that traditional theatre is actually the best example, the best exemplar for VR. Because in traditional theatre, you've got this problem that you can look anywhere, and in VR you get the same thing, whereas obviously in games or in film you've got the screen confines your view. And in some ways it really worked, and in some ways it didn't.
So just to rewind, this was in a theatre building, this was in an auditorium
at the RADA Studios in London. Yes.
Yep. So you're very much in I'm going to the theatre mode. You maybe get dressed up and have a nice dinner or whatever you do when you go to the theatre, go along with a friend or a partner, and then you slip on a VR headset.
Yes, it was just like that, except I arrived on my own late and really sweaty because I cycled there.
Excellent.
But yes, and this is always the odd thing about VR, is that it is so solitary, in that you go downstairs and there are these seats and this setting and you get this atmospheric talk through, and there are other people there, which is part of what makes theatre amazing. And then you put on this headset and bam, you're on your own. But then the way that it worked, I mean, for starters, it told a story about domestic violence, which is a much more serious theme than VR takes on. And I didn't totally love it all, but you could see within it that there was the bones of a really great story. And you could also see, and this is what I said in my review of it, that what would have happened if after you'd taken the headset off, for example, you'd moved, the world had changed, and then the action carried on in real life. And I think that in terms of performances, I think there's such potential for VR in this area.
Yeah, and something from your review that was interesting, you can read it on wire.co.uk, you talked through the various different technical techniques that it used to bring VR and bring storytelling. So some of the action takes place on a big screen, there's a world around you, so there's a screen within a screen, and you're in a screen.
Yes, and that worked absolutely brilliantly. And that's that thing that theatre people talk about being having the knack of capturing your attention and getting you to look where they want you to look. Yeah, it was. And one thing that was so brilliantly done was the sound. So it was using a combination of binaural spatial and stereo sound.
Yes.
And this combination, it was so effectively done because you had a mix. You could tell when sounds were coming from the screen. You could tell when sounds were in the virtual world around you. And then you also had this sense that there were other noises which were almost, as it were, in the room. And that's why when I took my headset off, I fully expected something to have changed in the room around me. There was action going on. And in fact, I'd just been fooled by this really clever audio, and instead nothing had really happened, but there was just some dry ice lying around.
So this is part of the failure of the production, that when it finishes, it very much finishes and you're just in a cupboard.
Yes, and I think, I didn't want to sound critical of the production, because I feel that with VR, it's in its early days and all the rules are being set and no one really knows what's going on. And so to see a really ambitious production like this that is pursuing in more kind of, I think, adventurous artistic ways was really fantastic. And I really look forward to seeing what they come with next.
Did everybody there get the same experience? Was everybody watching exactly the same thing at the same time? And did you take off your headset at any point during it just to have a look around to see how other people were reacting and experiencing this as well?
So, yes, everyone's experiencing the same thing. I checked afterwards. Although that's always the weird thing about VR, that you're like, you think, oh, I think we're all seeing the same thing, but you never really know. And that's what I mean. That would be so interesting to then interact afterwards, because you could really influence what people saw. I didn't take my headset off, in partly because it was quite gripping. And it was only 20 minutes long, but to be in a VR kind of production, that's really quite a long time. And I was fully involved.
And you've been doing quite a lot of research into VR and VR storytelling and VR worlds. What other interesting examples have you been coming across?
So there are some... I mean, VR is still, as I say, really in the early days. If there are a million people who own VR headsets out there, then that's probably the max. And those won't even be the really good headsets you can do all the really cool things on. But there are some really great things being made. There's some incredible artistic projects like Tilt Brush, which is Google's thing, that lets you paint in space. It is magical. There's also some amazing games, like really, really awesome games, where it's just like you're holding guns and you can shoot things and you see the real guns. And there's a game coming out.
This is HTC Vive's Space Pirate Train.
And this is the next big thing for VR, is when you can really move around in the world. And in this particular game I'm thinking of, Space Pirates Trainer, when the droids coming to attack you, shoot at you, you can dive out the way and then it'll miss you. It's kind of like the Wii, but just way, way cooler and better. And I can't wait until you can finally wield that lightsaber in VR. It is going to be epic.
Something that's maybe going to be of more impact, and Facebook investing very heavily in this, and Google and Twitter probably, I'm not sure, social VR. And we've seen it a little bit, I suppose, in an unrelated way with Pokemon Go, people just getting completely lost in an augmented version of reality.
Yes. So I believe that, and lots of people believe the same thing, that this is the next big thing for VR, when VR will really come into its own. And so really with VR, we're at the CD-ROM stage. You know, you get out your CD-ROM and you pop it.
VHS, sure.
Yeah. Well, either way, because I'm old enough to remember Encarta, this incredible encyclopedia that had so much knowledge in, and you popped it into your computer and it showed you some things.
If there wasn't a read error on the disc.
Yes. Yeah. Well, exactly. Or if the things weren't on there, and then it didn't show you those, and that was really cool. And that was just a solitary, it's kind of single, isolated experience. And then the internet came along, and the internet was this incredible connected web that would take you anywhere and you could go anywhere. And I guess most importantly, you could interact on it. And this is what people are saying with VR. We're at the CD-ROM stage or the VHS stage right now, but we are very rapidly coming towards the internet stage, which is where we will all be able to interact. And maybe that's just as basic as we'll have a Skype call and it will be incredibly personal, and the audio will mean that you can turn towards someone when they're speaking rather than just seeing everyone on a flat screen. Or, and this is the big vision, we'll be spending so much time on there, we'll be going to concerts on there, of course chasing Pokemon on there, living in Pokemon worlds, living in imaginary Pokemon worlds where we are ourselves Pokemon. Because, of course, it's VR, anything is possible.
Yeah, or being attacked by Pokemon.
Oh, that's quite scary.
Yeah, yeah, and the pain that you feel in the virtual world becomes real.
Ooh, yes, imagine that you were a Pokemon and some horrible James Templeton figure came up and flicked a little ball at you, and then you were trapped in that ball in his Pokedex, and you were able to get out.
To people that don't understand Pokemon, this is going to make no sense. So I'm going to put on my future goggles.
Oh.
Hello.
Oh, there they got are. Them on.
There there we go. And look way off into the distance.
Oh, I love
so the perfect marriage of people living in these social VR worlds is that, well, why do you need to speak to people? I might not want to speak to you, Roland. You might not be the person that I want to speak to right now. In fact, no one in the world might be the person that I want to speak to right now.
Hang on, I thought you were putting on your future goggles, not your grumpy old man goggles. Yeah.
So why couldn't there be a bot that knew everything about me because I've been on the internet for 20, 30, 40 years and handing over all of my data that creates the perfect human being for me to interact with? And in that virtual world, most of the people that you interact with are figments of your imagination created by artificial intelligence.
So, actually, those are quite good feature goggles. Yeah, it is a bit weird and scary. I mean, thinking a bit more realistically, I don't think... Well, there is this idea that we would want to spend all our time in virtual reality. And this idea is often referred to as the metaverse. That's where we'll be living. That's where we'll be doing everything. But I mean, personally, I just can't see it, because I guess we don't spend all our time on the internet. Okay, maybe a lot of our time.
But some people do.
Yes, and some people will. And if you look at, say, Second Life, and it's a very interesting comparison because one of the big VR worlds at the moment is being built by the creator of Second Life. I mean, Second Life, people really spent a lot of time on there. I mean, they were living most of their lives on there. And if VR is that much more convincing and basically that much better, then... Yeah, I mean, you can guarantee it. There are going to be some people who live, eat, sleep, and die in VR.
One of the things for me is where we draw the line between what is VR and what isn't. Because I know we're at a very early stage at the moment, but you get... So Facebook has been experimenting with 360 videos and 360 photos at the moment, and a lot of other companies are as well. But that was just the social aspect that I thought I'd bring back in there. And this is quite often called VR at the moment, and it's more just... a different form of storytelling and a different form of putting somebody into a different place and allowing them to view a different area. And I just want to get your opinions on, do you consider that to be virtual reality? Because for me, I would see virtual reality as being something that is completely out of our remits of what we understand at the moment, rather than just putting us into a different environment so we can view it in a different way.
Virtual reality is when... And there's a difference between in the environment and being in the environment, is where you're in it, and you can touch things and be convinced that the things that you're touching are real, and be convinced that the interactions that you're having are physical and genuine. And that's the huge leap that the technology has to make in terms of haptic feedback through gloves and force feedback, and being able to smell someone and sense someone and be able to really feel the city or the woodland around you. That's when it gets it, because one small failure in virtual reality technology brings the whole thing crashing down.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a huge, long period. Well, a bit like the internet itself, right? I mean, in fact, the internet, lots of things on the internet still look like sheets of paper. I mean, we call those things on our computer Windows. And, you know, that's another reference to an ancient technology. And there's going to be this long period when it's sort of like it resembles existing things. And maybe we'll never quite reach that point of total simulacrum. What do you say? Simulacrum?
Simulacrum.
Yeah, anyway, where it's a complete likeness of the world. But that is the goal. I've been speaking to a lot of... I've been out in San Francisco recently, talking to a lot of people working in this field, and they look you in the eye and they say, because of course, we want to create a world that is just like our world in virtual reality. And part of you thinks, hey, but, I mean, you're tall and... good-looking and a billionaire. Why don't you just spend your life in this world? But they really, really, really want to do it.
Final future goggle thing before I take them off. Why create the world that we already have? If you have an artificial intelligence that is able to conceive of things that we can't even imagine, which is, I was speaking to some astrophysicists recently, and they do this to your brain. This artificial intelligence is able to conceive of a universe and of a set of rules and understandings that we can't even begin to get our heads around. And that then creates an artificial world that is way more satisfying than the one we're currently in.
Ah, the Matrix is what you're referring to, really.
Yeah, you do kind of get that sense of Morpheus standing there with a couple of pills and a bunny.
You do, although I think So Philip Rosedale, who's the creator of Second Life and is now working on this VR thing. I mean, so one thing he said about AIs, which I thought was really interesting, he said, where will AIs live? They'll live in virtual reality. And if they're as intelligent as we think they're going to be, they might not necessarily want to hang around with us, but virtual reality might be a good place where we can interact with them and negotiate with them and also essentially stop them just destroying us, because they probably will be able to. And I think that's quite an interesting thought. There's a sci-fi book by a guy called Dan Simmons called Hyperion. And in that, the artificial intelligences are so supremely intelligent that they only speak in Zen koans. And you can't really understand anything they say, but you have to make the attempt all the same because they're so powerful. And maybe that'll be done in virtual worlds.
So is that your recommended reading for the week?
Oh, well, so much recommended reading. That is a great book. But if you haven't read Ready Player One by, I can't remember who it's by, but Steven Spielberg is making a film of it that's going to come out pretty soon. This is the book that everyone in this world refers to that really defines the metaverse. It's a great read, and read it before the film.
And before next week, there'll be a quiz all about it. There won't be. And we'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.